Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's just shortly after the hour of 1 o'clock. This afternoon, we will open House Committee on Revenue. This is the 16th of March. The Ides of March have passed us by. Today, my intention is to take the agenda kind of in reverse order from what it has been published. All bills that are scheduled today are scheduled for work session, and I intend to work several of these and at least have committee discussions on all of the rest of the bills that we don't work and finalize and move to the floor. So I will now begin by opening a work session on House Bill 2195A. Remember, colleagues, that this was the bill that had been passed previously by the committee, amended and passed, and then moved to the House floor. Others of our colleagues saw some issues that they were concerned about, and we have some amendments. Paul?
Mr. Chair, the committee met and discussed this bill back in February and approved it on a 9-0 vote. However, some issues came up as it was to be presented on the floor, and so the chair requested that it come back to committee to have an amendment to address some of the concerns that had been raised. And that amendment was drafted, and it's the A2 amendments in your should be in your packet today. The issue is around the cease and desist order. That was a key element of the bill. And what this does is clarify what should be included in that order.
We have before us then the dash A2 amendments dated March 14, 2005, basically providing the steps that are taken relative to the cease and desist order in order to bring that issue forward. Now, colleagues, this was an item that one of our colleagues, an attorney on the floor, said that he would feel much more comfortable if this was actually spelled out within the Oregon Revised Statutes dealing with the Board of Accountancy. The Board of Accountancy certainly recognized that as standard operating procedure relative to the cease and desist order and had no objections to that. Relative to the actual fact that the bill was on the floor, Representative Riley was prepared to carry it on the floor, and we appreciate your standing ready and willing and able to do that. Representative Riley, thank you very much. Representative Berger now moves the dash A2 amendments of March the 14th in this work session to House Bill 2195 as A appended. Are there any discussion relative to this motion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, the A2 amendments of March 14th, 05 are appended to 2195A engrossed. Any further discussion relative to this bill? Representative Riley now moves 2195 as B engrossed, be moved to the, with the dash A2 amendments of March the 14th, be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Riley, you'll be prepared again. Thank you very kindly. We appreciate that. Thank you, Carol, for and the Board of Accountancy for bearing with us as we work through that, and we wish you smooth sailing through both bicameral houses at this point. Thank you very much. We will close now the work session on House Bill 2195. Again, colleagues, we're moving back up the agenda in reverse order. We have now House Bill 2452. I will open a work session on House Bill 2452.
Okay, Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2452, this is a bill we've heard twice. This is one of them that you brought back and things. It never was filed, actually, but it was just returned to the committee for further action. And we had some amendments that needed to get added in. And then the last time we heard this bill, we had a dash one amendment, but then we had some additional language Department of Revenue wanted to add in. So basically, this is the one that was providing the guidelines for allowing pass-through entities to file a composite personal income or corporate excise tax return with the Department of Revenue on behalf of those non-resident owners who choose to be part of a composite return. And then it was specifying that a composite income tax return must include at least one non-resident owner It outlined the components of the composite income tax return and as a share, basically, of the distributive income from Oregon sources of each electing owner and the amount of tax then that would be withheld by the pass-through entity for each electing owner. And basically, it was also allowing an electing owner to file a non-resident personal income tax or corporate excise tax return. It also had the conditions under which then a pass-through entity shall withhold income taxes for non-resident owners' distributive income. So it was requiring then those pass-through entities to withhold taxes on distributive income from non-resident owners for those owners that are not electing to be part of a composite tax return. So basically, it also then outlined some conditions under which these pass-through entities are not required then to withhold taxes on behalf of the non-residents. And then that's where the amendment is fitting in, is that basically it's allowing then a new, it comes on your second page of that, or the last page of this bill, and basically just inserts in there on page 3 then a section E, which basically after line 10 of page 3, where you're basically allowing one more condition under which with taxes withheld would not have to occur, and basically it's allowing then a non-resident owner to file an affidavit then with the Department of Revenue to determine and collect any income taxes on the distributive income of a pass-through entity. But it also allows the Department of Revenue, which is the language that they wanted, it allows them to reject the affidavit of a taxpayer who is then failing to comply with Oregon law requiring the filing of a tax return or payment of any tax. So basically, this was just additional language to kind of give another situation in which a non-resident owner would file an affidavit with the Department of Revenue. But Department of Revenue could have the ability to reject that affidavit if they've seen in the past that they have not complied with Oregon law requiring the filing of a tax return or payment of any tax. So basically, this is not changing any of the revenue impact or anything. Again, with this bill, there isn't any specific revenue impact amount. There would be additional taxes that would be easier for the Department of Revenue to collect each year, but it really is indeterminate, but minimal, less than $50,000 per year.
Colleagues, you've heard the representation or the presentation and representations relative to this bill. Recall again that this bill had actually passed committee, and then we recalled it by unanimous approval of the committee to recall and examine this additional affidavit method by which it was prescribed that we collect the taxes in circumstances where there was a non-resident member of the partnership, and so this gave yet another it added yet another option as modified and as enhanced by the Department of Revenue. And we appreciate those folks who brought forward the original unintended consequence and the department's response as to how to further address the actual collection. You have before you the 2452-2 proposed amendment to House Bill 2452, dated 3/11/05. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 2452.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion to append the -2 amendments of March 11, 2005 to House Bill 2452. Discussion relative to that motion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2452 as amended by the -2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, you've heard the motion to move 2452 as engrossed with the -2 amendments. This would be an A engrossed piece of legislation. Discussion relative to this motion. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Hass, will you carry this to the House, please?
I will, Mr. Chair, as soon as some of us recover from our dyslexia we have with this bill and 2544.
Yeah,
same file, same
year. This is a
problem with all of us. I think my staff has sent down as many as three bills at one time on this particular matter. So thank you very much, colleagues. We will then close the work session on House Bill 2452. Moving back up now, we are on the third item, and the middle item as we're moving back up the stream. And, colleagues, I will now open a work session on House Bill 2469. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, with House Bill 2469, to just recap, we heard this bill yesterday, and basically this is allowing the taxable estate value for Oregon estate tax purposes to be reduced by the value of all of the Oregon special marital property in the estate. So basically this is dealing with that one particular deduction for special marital property in an estate. And it broadens then this definition of Oregon's special marital property to include trust with discretionary income distribution. It also allows an executor of the estate to elect the amount of the trust that will qualify for the marital deduction. It's also specifying the requirements and forms necessary to qualify property as Oregon's special marital property. It clarifies that upon the death of the surviving spouse, the value of that Oregon special marital property will be included then in the gross estate value in calculating those taxes. It allows an amended estate tax returns to be made for deaths occurring on or after January 1st, 2002, and before then the effective date of this measure. Basically, it also is specifying that if refunds are made as a result of the amended estate tax return pertaining to a change in this Oregon special marital election, then the refund doesn't have to be made with interest if the refund is made on or after March 1st, 2007. Then at that time, after March 1st, 2007, those refunds would be paid with interest. It takes effect 90 days after the end of the 2005 regular legislative session. And again, this is part of an interim work group that really kind of looked at estate tax planning area after our 2003 legislative changes. And you'll basically have CPAs that will go through an example there for you of some of the changes and some of the problems that could occur for certain taxpayers. And so this basically, as we talked about yesterday, in the long term, there will be no revenue loss in the state general fund because the states basically will be paying this Oregon estate tax. It's just a matter of the timing of when they're actually going to be paying it.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. We'll invite the CPAs forward. If you would come forward, please, Mark and Carrie. And Carrie, you provided us with a handout on 2469, and we should all have this at our desk today relative to the issue regarding planning and no planning. Please.
Chair Butler and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I'm here representing the tax section of the Oregon State Bar as well as the Oregon Society of CPAs. I think on the overview, just wanted to kind of give you a review of how the Oregon taxes work compared to the federal taxes. And I think, as Lizbeth has said, we've got a disconnect right now between Oregon taxes and federal taxes that cause individuals to have to pay estate taxes in Oregon at the death of the first spouse where they're not planning to do so. And the bill before you is a very discrete fix that would only allow a deferral of that tax until the death of the second taxpayer. So the example that I have before you shows a couple that has an estate of $2 million. And I think typically we're finding that a lot of times this may be a taxpayer that has some farmland that because of the value of the land, it's tied up in the farm, it's tied up in timber property, something like that. And so what happens is at the death of the first spouse, suddenly if they have to come up with some tax dollars, it's very difficult for them to try to tap into that farm or timberland or have to sell something in order to pay the tax.
Carrie, this could be a $25,000 per post-World War II home in Portland.
Yes, it could
today.
Be. Many homes have increased in value such that unless they're sold, the tax could not be paid, though, for mortgage.
And it's important to know that the that an estate includes the personal residence, even though the personal residence is used exclusively personally and just for the benefit of the surviving spouse or the decedent's heirs, immediate heirs. So it would not be uncommon in the world that we're looking at in the very near future to have someone who owns a small home and a small retirement account to be fitting into this, and someone who wouldn't have believed otherwise that they had any real estate planning to do, and other folks who are really not genuinely informed, perhaps worked good employment throughout their lives and have retired comfortably, but always thought that their home was tax exempt. The sale of it is. We're talking about a different kind of tax here. Thank you, Carrie.
Yes, sir. And I think we are seeing that a lot, both in the city and outside of the city, and that's where a lot of people with their farmland that is starting to get on the outskirts of the city suddenly is worth more than the taxpayer is expecting, and suddenly it is their home and their livelihood, and they're going to have to tap into something. Under current, and I'm just going to go over an overview of federal estate tax laws, and it pairs in with Oregon tax law. Under federal tax laws, if a husband and wife can leave as many assets as they'd like to their spouse without paying any tax. So many people do either don't prepare a will or a trust, or just leave all of their assets to their spouse at their death. It's what we call an I love you will if they have had a will prepared. In that situation, there is no tax to be paid at the death of the first person. But under current federal tax laws, at the death of the second person, they can only exempt $1.5 million from their estate. And so they are subject to estate tax on that additional $500,000. They've effectively lost the $1.5 million exemption they could have had at federal level because they left everything directly to their surviving spouse. However, under both Oregon and federal tax laws, estate tax laws, there would be no tax to pay at the first death of the first spouse, but as shown on that chart, at the death of the second spouse, there would be both federal and Oregon tax to be paid at the death of the second spouse. On federal, they get $1.5 million exemption. They'll be paying tax on the other $500,000. For Oregon purposes, they have a $950,000 exemption, and they would be paying tax on the other $1,050,000. What most wills and trusts do if somebody is in that situation is we try to set it up so that the couple gets the benefit of both exemptions for both of the spouses. And so what happens is on that second page, at the death of the first individual, instead of leaving everything just directly to the surviving spouse, a trust is established so that it puts half of the estate of the person who has died into a trust, and it's there for the benefit of the survivor to use during his or her lifetime. And for that reason, it's not subject to tax because it's under that $1.5 million exemption, again, when I'm looking at federal law. So then what happens is at the death of the second spouse, it comes in and we're looking at the estate of the second spouse to die. The first spouse put $1 million into this trust, and it is not subject to tax at the death of the second spouse. Instead, the second spouse has only $1 million to be taxed at his or her death. And in my example, I've had the wife surviving. She has $1 million in her estate at a federal level. She has $1.5 million exemption, and there's no federal tax to be paid. At an Oregon level, she does have $50,000 taxed in her estate, and there would be a little bit of Oregon tax to be paid. This sort of highlights the problem that we have. A lot of those wills and trusts have been drafted using that federal dollar amount for the exemption, and it says place into that credit shelter trust the full amount that can be exempted from federal tax. So it would place the whole $1 million in that credit shelter trust. But under Oregon law, only $950,000 of it can be exempt from tax. Therefore, at the death of the first spouse, $50,000 is going to be subject to Oregon tax. And as you can see, it's at a fairly high rate percentage-wise. It would trigger tax of $19,500 to be paid at the death of the first spouse. Just because of the way the Oregon tax structure works, that first $100,000 is taxed at a much higher percentage. So what we're asking for this discrete fix is to instead allow that whole $1 million to go ahead and remain in that trust and not be taxed at the first death, but to be taxed at the second death. And so that extra $50,000 in this example would be subject to tax at the wife's death in Oregon, but we would allow it to escape tax in the death of the first person. So again, that they don't have to sell their property in order to come up with the tax. I think it is important to realize that we can go back and revise wills and trusts so that it accomplishes the same purpose. What we're trying to do is to allow people to avoid having to go back to their attorney and have these redrafted.
Thank you. Mark, did you want to?
For the record, Chair Butler, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hugland. I'm with the Oregon State Bar, and I think Kerry has summarized it very well. I think the only thing is, under current Oregon law, many taxpayers, their wills will actually qualify. So all our bill does, it's just a very discreet fix that allows an election to be made on a certain other types of trusts that have different, slightly different provisions, and it's just a very simple technical fix that we're really asking for.
Thank you, Mark. And this, Kerry, you mentioned that this did come out of the an interim work group, and then has advanced forward through the Committee on Judiciary at the request of the Oregon State Bar Taxation Section, yes, which are members of both the bar section as well as the
CPA. That is correct, Chair Butler. We, numerous estate tax attorneys and tax attorneys and CPAs, as well as members of the Department of Revenue, all worked for a long time to look at what fix we might come up with that doesn't cause any additional taxes to the state of Oregon, and this is what we came up with as a resolution.
Is that what estate tax and estate attorneys do for fun when they get together?
Oh, yes.
Oh. For real,
sort of like CPAs.
Party hats.
Touché. White chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Kerry or for Mark? Thank you again for preparing this this information regarding the Credit Shelter Trust. Colleagues, any questions that want to come forward with this time? Thank you again.
Thank you.
Kerry,
thanks,
Mark. We appreciate the good work you do. And Paul, in the interim, would you see that their compensation for working on that group is double? Okay. We really do appreciate the work of these fine people that come and help us with these issues. Colleagues, you've had an opportunity to have hearings now on 2469. We've had hearings that went back in the month of February, and now a couple of hearings, one scheduled yesterday, and now today. I would entertain a motion then relative to moving 2469 to the full floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Pomp?
I'd make a motion, Chairman Butler, to have 2469 moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
The motion has been made that 2469 move to the floor of the whole House, full House of Representatives, with a due pass recommendation. Discussion relative to that motion. Objection. Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Representative, as we go down the row here, let's see, Representative Boquist.
Why did I know this was coming? Because it has to do with the state tax, right?
It has to do with the state tax, and you're doing a good job there. So, so Representative Boquist will carry that to the full House and do pass recommendation. We will now close the work session on 2469. Representative Boquist, while we have you on the hot seat for a moment, perhaps we could move back up to 2629 at this time. We will open a work session on 2629. Colleagues, this is the estate tax gross estate threshold, and we've had Representatives Boquist and Riley working on these issues. We've had opportunities to receive some of the information in the committee, and Representative Riley, because I'm looking your way, maybe I could have you just give your impressions of the work that you've done thus far.
My impression is that Brian did most of the work and did a good job. What we've come up with is five alternative ways that we might go with this bill. Four or five of them I don't like, but that's okay. We'll move on with those. But what we would like to do, Mr. Chair, is take these to our respective caucuses and get some idea of where we want to go,
okay,
and come back with those, if that's okay.
Okay, you bet. Thank you very much. We appreciate the work that you're doing. Perhaps we could just have Elizabeth, did you have anything to add to the information? You had an opportunity to prepare a number of arrays on this and have had the opportunity to work directly with Representatives Riley and Boquist. Any special comments you'd like to make relative to this estate tax issue?
Well, Chairman Butler, I would just say that what I've been giving you so far, anyway, are all static numbers. So I know there was some interest in having kind of dynamic numbers as far as some of the feedback effects mm-hmm. from having this particular tax cut for a state. So I can run that in the Oregon Tax Incident Model to give you some feedback on the magnitude of that, if that's helpful.
So. So if we could have that before we carry this to our caucuses, that would be appreciated.
That may make a difference.
It certainly may.
Yeah.
Okay.
As to the outcome, Representative Boquist, your response.
I believe, Mr. Chairman, I mean, you wanted me to just roughly outline the.
Why don't you go through the four options and do nothing option as the fifth, I guess. So.
Yes. And again, as Representative Riley said, we've come to no conclusion here. We're just brainstorming and putting this together, and we're still working with staff to come up with.
Well, that's. I'd hope you've come to a conclusion, voted it out amongst yourself, and you're ready to take it to the floor.
Sorry.
You are quite optimistic, Mr. Chair. Generally speaking, of the five options, and I'll give a quick brush, because please don't get wrapped up in the details, fellow members, because we don't have the details per se. But most of this, the first option, of course, is simply increasing to implement this bill at the revenue neutral, complete revenue neutral in this session and the next session, which would be 05, and then the 07 session, was to increase the top end rates. And we've seen some of those, and Lizbeth has modeled some of those, and they range between 20 and 47%. Second option is an option of more compression, and it's a combination of compression and a little bit of top-end raising. Again, revenue neutral in the 05-07 session, 07-09 session. That does a 13% increase and then a 9% increase. And again, don't hold us to that because we're still working on those factors. The third option, which was not necessarily the easiest one, was just take the bill at face value and apply it. That then creates a revenue neutral in the 05-07, but in the 07-09, there's a $19 million price tag on that. And that's, again, just taking bill at face value, going to the $1.5 million in the first year, which, remember, this begins in 07, and then going on to the following year to the $2 million mark. The fourth option was just, okay, what happens if we reconnect to the federal code in 07? And that means we would line with the federal code, not the 1.5 or the 3. And that is roughly $24 million price tag. Again, revenue neutral in 05-07, but a $24 million price tag out. And, of course, option 5, which is always an option for the legislature, as most people watching the tape know, and that is do nothing. So those are the five options that we have. What we have looked at is going back in several of those options and ask Lizbeth to put some dynamics into this, so we can actually see what the total picture would look like to us, and then be able to come back as a small working group first and determine what we think is really feasible, and then going out to the other committee members and talk to them. And that's kind of where we are right now, Mr. Chair. Am I correct?
That sounds right to me.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, it was a week ago today that we moved forward with this small ad hoc, bipartisan ad hoc group to take a look at this. We express our appreciation for the work which you've done. By the authority vested in me as the chair, I'm going to continue with the ad hoc group for another 5 to 7 days to allow you to go ahead and work with the legislative revenue staff, Elizabeth Martin-Haar, to go ahead and get the OTEMS modeling done so that we can get a better feel for that. And then please take this back to your respective caucuses so that we'll have a better feel so that all of our colleagues in the House will have a better feel for the important issues that are relating to this. I appreciate and express appreciation to each of you for the work that you've done, as well as our staff, in modeling these various options, and to come back with five potential things it could do, four of which were really options. I don't know that doing nothing is a very good option for most of us, particularly when we've had pretty strong feelings about what this can do to small businesses. So Again, I appreciate the work that you're doing. Elizabeth?
And Chairman Butler, I forgot one other point, too. I am working on looking at smoothing out that really steep curve that you get when you first come on the estate taxes. So looking at some kind of a new tax rate structure just for those, you know, first million, maybe from 1 million to 2 million, then looking at a little different rate structure and then going up to our old existing one. But then that's going to require, again, then some, if you're going to make it revenue neutral, then you've got to, you know, have some additional little higher tax rates on those others. But it shouldn't have a real big impact. But just so everyone's knowing, that is another thing that I'll start working on. Yeah, it just, that's something you could take, and I can run, I'm running that at 1 million right now, but I can run it again at 2 million just because that's the other threshold that we're looking at.
1.5 and 2 million.
Okay, I could put 1.5. Yeah, I just did 1 million and 2 million, but if you want to look at 1.5 and 2,
okay.
I can do that. Yeah, so anyway, just to give you a sense, I think that is something that we got a lot of comments on during interim when this bill was first passed, is why is there such a high rate here as soon as you come on? Mm-hmm. And that was just hard to explain to people. And so if we could kind of clean that up a bit in the tax structure, and it's not like you have to use, you know, that existing federal state death tax credit schedule as it is. You know, you can modify it, and that's basically what we're
looking at. Again, that smoothing at the bottom end would have the effect of saying, folks, but for the fact that the legislature did take action, you would have paid a lot more death tax at this low rate, and by moving that through, then the smoothing in effect keeps it towards that bottom end, and that'll be interesting to see that as well. So with that, colleagues, we'll get a report back. We'll schedule us back for probably even time next week and proceed with it at that point, and I'll look to you as the leaders from the committee and to give us the sign from your caucuses as to what your feel is as you come back. Thank you very much. We will then close the work session on House Bill 2629 and move that forward for a reschedule, probably next Tuesday or Wednesday, as soon as we can get that rescheduled after you've had an opportunity to meet on that. Now, let's see. What was the reason we came today? I will open a work session on House Bill 2542. Colleagues, 2542 is the Reconnect. We have spent, Elizabeth can keep track of our schedules here and tell us how long we've spent on 2542 and the iterations that she's worked on. And again, by way of acknowledgement and appreciation, we do appreciate the many hours you have spent on this, Elizabeth, and let's see where we can take it today. So, colleagues, we'll turn some time over to Elizabeth. I've asked her to do a couple of things, including before we're done today, before we're ready to see whether or not we have the votes to vote this out, to at least take us through a number of the high points in the legislation again, and to try and address those issues which have come before us by folks who have expressed concern from the public as we have considered this particular House Bill 2542.
Okay, and Chairman Butler, you want me to start with the amendments just to make sure that
we've got two amendments which are disparate and unique. So let's take a look at those. We should have those already.
First of all, just to make sure everybody's clear again, basically the dash one, the dash two are very similar, except for the only major difference is the dash one begins that rolling reconnect basically at the beginning of this year, January 1st, 2005. So there wouldn't be that one-year break of not having a rolling reconnect. So basically what this is doing, it also brings in the issue with the definition of a child and specifying in there the amount that the child has to have the relationship defined as far as broader than just your own immediate child. It could be a grandchild and those issues that we have been discussing. So that just clarifies you can't pay your own child for those child care expenses. It would have to, that would be an excludable item there.
Elizabeth, that in part addresses the issues that Representative Nielsen brought us from another bill.
Yeah, and really it was Representative Nielsen's changes in her bill that brought the flag forward that, yes, we needed to change that particular language in this bill also. So, but we've got the qualifying child language already in the existing bill. That broadens the definition so that we are including the grandparents, which was what Representative Nelson's bill was doing. And so we're
under either the dash one or the dash two amendments, that is,
yeah,
that is addressed.
Really the existing bill has qualifying child broadened to the Internal Revenue Code statutes, which then is a broader definition, which includes even like we were talking about nieces and nephews and various relationships like that, foster children and stuff. So basically while you have in this dash one and dash two, it's also clarifying that those children that you have in that whatever relationship you have with that child, being your grandchild or your niece or your nephew, you will not be allowed to pay them, you know, child care expenses and then claim the child care tax credit. So that's all this clarifying language is doing there. But it also goes on and talks about requiring then, it gets into the dividend component that we were discussing in great detail, and basically it's requiring Oregon law to conform with that federal law and not allowing dividends received deduction for certain dividends that are already not allowed a dividend deduction in federal law. And these IRCs 243 and or the 975C, which is the new statute that now the dividends received from foreign controlled corporations are actually classified now as Internal Revenue Code 945C. So they, in the future, those dividends received from foreign controlled corporations will not be allowed a dividend deduction here in Oregon. So we'll be cleaning up that issue and conforming with federal law. And this includes the REITs. So basically that's going in there, and it's deleting that section we already have in 19. So down here towards the end of the bill, 17. Section 17, and it's the ORS 317-267, which shows the Department of Revenue how to calculate the dividend deduction received. Deduction. So it's basically saying we will not be allowing certain dividend deductions the same as what federal law is allowing. It also then is, though, conforming for that one-year period of Oregon's tax treatment of dividends received from foreign-controlled corporations to be consistent with federal law in the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. So remember, in the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004, we have an 85% dividends deduction that was to stimulate repatriation of foreign earnings back to the U.S. parent corporation for a temporary period of time. So we are connecting to that. So we will be allowing that 85% dividends deduction received. But remember, as we had testimony, we will not be allowing our current law practice, which would have given a 97% dividends deduction for those particular dividends.
The compounding of the dividends.
The compounding of it. So basically this is saying we'll just be giving that 85% dividends deduction for that one-year period, and then we'll be going back to federal law, which is not allowing any dividends deduction for those foreign-controlled corporation dividends. And then it also specifies that it applies to federal law changes beginning January 1st, 2005. That, again, is reestablishing that rolling reconnect beginning January 1st, 2005. So basically, any changes that will be occurring then between now and the end of the year, we will be connecting with if they pertain to taxable income with the Dash 1 Amendment. Now, with the Dash 2 Amendment, basically what it's doing is it's not establishing the rolling reconnect, okay? So there'll be a gap then between January 1st, 2005 and the end of January 31st, 2005 that where we won't have an automatic connection. So that's the difference. But what it does is it goes in there and then specifies additional components that will be part of the rolling reconnect, as far as allowing certain definitions that are pertaining to taxable income. Those would be ones we would conform with. It adds amortization to the list, as well as federal military compensation benefit changes to the list that we would be actually connecting to. So if Congress did pass another military act and it dealt with the compensation benefits, you would be capturing that in both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. Those changes would be conformed to. But just recognize, again, all of these are just changes that pertain to taxable income. So that's all we are allowed to have a rolling reconnect to. And that's what basically you have with the Dash 2. It's got all the other components that you have in the Dash 1 with the changes in the definition of the child. And the dividends deduction changes are exactly the same in the Dash 2 and the Dash 1.
Colleagues, we've got both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s before us. They are distinct and separate. The one issue that we do not have with regard to the Dash 2s, I don't know, do we have an idea of the revenue impact on the Dash 2s?
Chairman Butler, they're exactly the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's...
So both, because, and the reason why that is because you haven't had any federal legislation that has occurred here that you haven't connected to yet. You had the tsunami 2005 legislation, but we already have that addressed in this bill. So we don't have any new legislation that would cause us to have to, look at the impact due to the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Elizabeth, there are questions, Mark?
Thank you. A little unclear about the automatic reconnect here in the language. It says reestablishes the rolling reconnect. It makes me wonder why we even need legislation for the automatic reconnect if it's going to do that automatically.
Well, Chairman Butler and Representative Hatz, if you remember from last session's bill, we were going to reestablish then the rolling reconnect January 1st, 2006. So that's already established in current law. So what we're doing right now with House Bill 2542 is we've still got this date specific all over. Remember, this December 31st, 2004 is what, we're going to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what we're then creating with just the existing bill of 2542 and, say, the Dash 2 amendment is that you will, if you have any changes that occur in Congress between January 1st, 2005 and the end of December 31st, 2005, you won't be connecting with it automatically. And that was, part of the discussion from last session is you don't know exactly what Congress is going to do while you guys aren't in session, and so it's very hard to predict whether or not that would cause the state a revenue loss. And so this is a way of protecting yourself from not having revenue losses right away. And so that was part of the discussion from last session, and that's what you have here in just moving this to December 31st, 2004. You still have a date-specific connection to federal law.
Berkeley?
I do understand that for the other parts of this, but for the automatic changes, what I remember from last session was we didn't have, we technically don't have to do anything. So I'm just, when it says reestablishes the rolling reconnect, I'm trying to look for the language that says reestablishes. I guess it's just the date, but I was just kind of thinking.
Yeah, okay. So with the Dash 1 amendment, maybe that's what... Because you're meaning what exactly is the language that does that, or because it's
on the sort of what we would call the A and B part of this, not the C, but the A and B part.
Remember okay, that? Yeah. So A and B we've already connected to.
Right. And so when you say allows the automatic connection or reestablishes, I guess what I was really wondering was if we did nothing here. A lot of this would automatically happen. We just wouldn't have any. We just wouldn't have the new connections.
So. Right. Yeah. And you basically wouldn't have what's on this, second page. Basically everything like the repeal of the ETI deduction for U.S. production activities.
Okay.
S corporation changes. I mean, so this whole page you wouldn't have.
Well, he did nothing.
So I guess I'm wondering why there's not two bills, one for the rolling reconnect and one for the new one.
Well, Chairman Butler and Representative Hass, that's sure something you could do. I mean, the dash one is basically bringing forward that rolling reconnect, and it's not having a revenue impact because it just we haven't seen anything change. It's more perspective and looking forward. Where the bill itself, you know, with 2542 by itself, you're just changing this connection date, looking at the past, and looking at what we've already seen as far as federal legislation and then what we would be connecting to it. So all that reestablishing the rolling reconnect is just bringing it forward 1 year than what we did last session.
Further discussion relative to the presentation thus far. Colleagues have also asked Elizabeth to come back. One of the issues that was kind of important and caught me a little bit off guard was relative to the health savings accounts, and so I'd asked, because we had some pretty profound testimony regarding to the health savings account to connect or not to connect, I asked Elizabeth if she would just quickly re-review the HSA issues with us.
Okay, and so Chairman Butler and committee members, I basically would just point you to the handout I gave you and things that day, and I do have a kind of an explanation of the federal subsidies for the Medicare prescription drug plans.
On page 4?
Yeah, on page 4, as well as page 5, then there's the health savings account. So basically, as we had discussed, you know, this is really designed for individuals, and it's only for those individuals, though, who are covered by a high-deductible health plan. So right now, a lot of people aren't under these high-deductible health plans. And as you can see there, that includes a plan with an annual deductible that is at least $1,000 for individuals or $2,000 for a family or two or more persons. So basically, they have to be on a high-deductible health plan, and then they get an above-the-line deduction on their personal income tax returns for contributions made to their health savings accounts each year. Then basically the distributions from those health savings accounts for any qualified medical expenses that they have are excluded then from gross income. So it's basically, you know, it's diverting money into health savings accounts, which then is not ever included in gross income. And the reason basically why Congress established these health savings accounts and why they allowed then this new personal income tax deduction was really to encourage individuals to accept these higher deductible health plans and begin these health savings accounts in order to pay for their higher medical expenses that they're going to have to incur because they have a higher deductible. But basically, with this, we also had testimony discussing whether or not corporations, you know, were going to, because those contributions that corporations make for their employees into these accounts can also be deducted from the corporation's expenses and stuff can be deducted from their taxable income. So that's something that I have a call in to just verify that the numbers and estimates that we were seeing on the health savings accounts did include the corporate component, but I haven't gotten a response yet definitively, but one person said they thought it was. But just so everyone's clear, that basically is a reduction of about $3.7 million in 2005-07 biennium and about $4.5 million 2007-09 biennium. And as far as the other flip side of that was then also part of the Medicare prescription drug plan were these federal subsidies for Medicare prescription drugs plans. And I did find as I was kind of diving again into this literature about this, the calculation of these estimates, is that also union drug plans were something that were discussed a lot in Congress and stuff. And so they would also qualify for these federal subsidies for Medicare. So basically, this is allowing employers who provide qualified drug coverage through plans, and they have to, you know, have to be a good drug coverage plan that are established by Congress, then they would receive these federal Medicare payments, and then these Medicare subsidies are then excluded from the employer's gross income. So prior to this, U.S. corporations would report subsidies
you know, that they would get from the federal government as income in determining their federal corporate taxable income. But under current law, then a taxpayer, and this was something that they brought up at the federal level, was basically you could have a corporation that may claim a deduction for the prescription drug expenses that they incur for the employees and then also receive a subsidy and then take that also out. So there wasn't even a provision for double counting in this particular legislation. So the reason that was kind of given for this federal subsidy, it really was to ensure that all Medicare beneficiaries are able to purchase these affordable prescription drug insurance. It really was trying to encourage corporations to keep these better drug plans in place. And excluding the federal subsidies from income for tax purposes, we're trying to encourage employers then to begin also new prescription drug plans, as well as encourage the existing employers and unions to currently offer these prescription drug plans at the federal level. So basically that causes a reduction then, as we've talked about, in Oregon's corporate tax revenue by roughly $9.2 million in the 05-07 biennium and $9.5 million in the 07-09 biennium.
Okay. Question?
Representative Gleason?
When you were talking about I'm not sure if you were talking in past or present tense when you said that there was a concern about double counting for corporations. So was that, was that concern addressed? Or
no. Okay, Chairman Butler and Representative Glizzo, what I was meaning in the past was when Congress passed this.
Okay.
This was literature that I was reading that, you know, it was something that was pointed out that you could claim these prescription expenses as a deduction, even though you were receiving also a subsidy for those expenses.
And that's in it.
That's in it.
Okay.
That's all part of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions regarding the health savings account portion and portions of pages 4 and 5 regarding the Medicare Prescription Drug and Improvement and Modernization Act, as well as the HSAs that we had previously discussed? And those again are on pages 4 and 5 of the handout from yesterday, wasn't it? Okay. That we received yesterday. Colleagues, we're at the point, and I probably need to say something relative to the testimony which has been offered here. I want to express appreciation for those folks who have come forward and have expressed some genuine concern about the fact that we'd like to have Oregon raise as much as it possibly can by having folks, businesses, and individuals establish for their small business accounts separate sets of books, but that gives all the appearance of the Accountants Full Employment Act. And I want you to know that while I live with and appreciate and work with accountants all the time, they would just as soon, and we've heard today from some accountants as well, they just assume that these kinds of things not happen, that Oregon keep as closely connected as possible to federal. We've been able to successfully do that with regard to many depreciation matters, and this will continue the depreciation, even though under federal law there is an expansion of the depreciation. This continues to keep the state of Oregon connected to the federal depreciation reports, and I think that's important. And then the other thing it does is it allows corporations, as we heard yesterday from the folks here from Monaco Coach, come forward and say, you know, we just as soon not have two sets of business or two sets of books for the state of Oregon, where Oregon is a home base for us. We do business in all 50 states, and including another major manufacturing plant with the other half of their operations in Indiana, but that if they in fact had to do a complete secondary set of Oregon books, then what would happen is that second set of books would have to be considered in the utilization of their tax plan or of their tax returns in all 49 other states, including the state of Indiana, making it just doubly difficult when you've got these kinds of adjustments. So that said, I also would like to say that I've been disappointed in all of the business that came forward, all the corporate business that came forward, that they have not, and maybe it's been a lack of my ability to question the businesses that have come forward and testified on behalf of keeping us connected, as to what specific benefit each of these businesses will enjoy as a result of maintaining the various kinds of links to the federal tax or the additional tax breaks, if you will, that are provided for under federal law. I would like to know that will make a specific difference in the amount of money that they invest in employees, in family wage jobs in Oregon, and in property, plant, and equipment, which will be in Oregon. And I have not heard specific testimony that's what this legislation will do. So I'm disappointed that those folks haven't been able to say, intuitively I think that it's the case that if they can justify continuing to do business in the state of Oregon without the additional costs of having number one, a different set of books, and number two, a greater actual state tax costs in the state of Oregon than they would experience in many other states. I still am anxious about the fact that I would like to know what this translates to in terms of family wage jobs and invest in Oregon and investments in property, plant, equipment in Oregon, so as to bolster the property tax base locally and to be able to provide family wage jobs, where that's our key to getting out of the current difficult times that we've had in Oregon, is jobs. You know, when we have 2 months in a row to put us back up over the job losses which we experienced in the early portion of this decade, and that's front page, top of the above the fold news. When that happens, I'd like to have had industry come forward and tell us this means that we will be able to continue to do that in Oregon for a period of X number of more months, that we will make additional investments in Oregon, or that we will not disinvest in the state. So I've tried to express that concern as well as I possibly could to the folks, and again, part of what I may be missing here is that I may not have communicated this properly to the folks that have testified before us. But if I'm being too tough on those industries, I'm sure they'll tell me. But I am very anxious about the issue of decoupling Oregon or disconnecting Oregon with regard to the 2003-2004 acts, which the federal government implemented for the specific purpose of trying to bolster the job economy in the United States. Because if Oregon says that's great for the feds to do it, and we heard yesterday that it was in a bipartisan fashion that it happened, that Senator Smith joined with Senator Wyden, and that they advanced this, and that we had a bipartisan vote in the House of Representatives to continue to do this, those folks knew it was important for Oregon. But to have Oregon disconnect, I think, would be somewhat shoddy business practice for us, and disconcerting for those folks who brought us this opportunity to encourage investment and jobs growth and job creation in the United States. So at this particular point, the only other thing that I could think to do would be to come back and have line by line any questions which you may have relative to the proposal which is before us, and further discussion of the dash one or the dash two amendment possibilities and what that would mean to the folks in Oregon. Again, I think the businesses told us yesterday that or over the portion of our hearings that we've had thus far on this particular bill, that they would like to see us fully reconnect as soon as we possibly can, which would mean the dash one amendments to the bill at present. Questions? Comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
I echo some of your same concerns. But I think it's important to remember that with the exception of one or two provisions, we will, you know, nobody's talking about not connecting to anything. There may be one or two tough provisions. And other states, including Massachusetts, whose Republican governor led that effort to decouple from everything. I don't think anyone's talking about that. And I do share your anxiety about having two sets of books here, but I also share your anxiety about the case for $40 million in general fund revenues hasn't been made. For example, with this federal subsidy for Medicare prescription drug plans, I don't think we had one word of testimony in favor of that provision or why it would make sense, or here's how many people we would employ in addition to what we have, or here's the plant we would build, or any of those benefits to justify that expense. And I agree with you that the case just hasn't been made yet for some of these.
Further comments, questions, observations? Colleagues, it's going to be my intention that we work this bill no later than Tuesday of this next week.
Okay.
That we will have an opportunity to go back to our districts where we may have some of the organizations and corporations within our districts that may have further light and knowledge and information that they can bestow upon us relative to the issues in this bill. But I this is a plea from the chair at this particular point that business and industry, if they have to make a case, or if they intend to make a case for the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement Modernization Act of 2003, or the other provisions of this bill, as Representative Hass has indicated, that those folks be in touch with us, and that we bring back on Tuesday this bill with the idea that we will pass it up or down on with an amendment, either the dash one or the dash two, and that and we invite business and industry to come forward with written testimony relative to why it is that it's important to our districts. And I know that we've got folks here from many different kinds of districts. It will make very little difference to the couple of industries that I have in my House District 60. It will make some difference. I anticipate that folks, I know that folks are presently investing in HSAs, anticipating that they already have. I received at least three emails from families in rural Oregon that have said that they're already at $2,500 and higher deductible with large family amounts on the HSA. So, and they're saying, don't discourage us from investing in HSAs. Don't do anything that would decouple Oregon from the HSAs. So, colleagues, I'm very anxious to hear your responses, which you will have, and ask for staff to reschedule us for Tuesday of next week, and we will move this bill. Please, you've been given packets. The vice chairs have been given packets to review with your colleagues and your respective caucuses. I'm anxious to move forward with a bipartisan bill that we can live with, that will attempt to encourage job growth and instill back into industry the opportunity or the desire to return to Oregon with family wage jobs and make those kinds of investments in property, plant, and equipment, which for a long term, which will help us. And I know there's lots of bills in the process that do this, but I'm anxious that we not impede that by doing anything which would violate the trust which is in us relative to House Bill 2542 and the reconnect. So with that, colleagues, I'm going to go ahead and close our work session on House Bill 2542. If there's no further business before the committee today, we'll stand adjourned until tomorrow at even time. Thank you.